Good morning. I want to begin, of course, by thanking Codex. It's an amazing opportunity to speak here today. Historians love pivot points, those times when energies converge and the future can unfold in strikingly different directions. Life seems so unknowable and chaotic on the near side of a shift, and then 10 years on, events seem to have aligned into the only possible outcome. I believe that the Book Arts are, once again, at such a pivot point, previous ones being in the 1960s and 1980s. Here's the good news. There is no question that, in the past 30 years, the Book Arts, and in particular letterpress printing, have expanded and matured light years beyond my imaginings when I joined the field in 1984. As I'm now researching letterpress in the U.S. from 1980 to 2010, my comments here today will reflect that focus. Let's begin by revisiting a few key moments for letterpress from the last 35 years, inspired by related images on the screen. 1982, the Fine Printing Conference at Columbia University takes place, sharing information pre-internet. 1985, Minnesota Center for Book Arts opens, following the Center for Book Arts in New York, and along with many others now today, one of a multiplying number of nonprofits committed to securing equipment and studio facilities for letterpress and the other book arts. 1987, Jim Trissell's Color for the Letterpress book is published, which infuses letterpress practice with a painter's sensibility. Early 90s, desktop publishing does a mind meld with photopolymer plate makers. It's not an ideal marriage, but it breathes life into letterpress and welcomes imagery onto the page. 1994, Peter Verheyen founds the Book Arts Listserv. That same year, Oak Knoll Fest begins. 1998, Gerald Lang publishes digital printing on the Cylinder Hand Press. 2000, Hamilton Woodtype and Museum is founded in Two Rivers, Wisconsin, for the protection and celebration of woodtype. 2005, Wellesley College's ABC Conference directs our focus to collecting, and in another part of the collecting universe, Etsy is founded. 2007, the first Codex International Book Fair and Symposium. And 2008, the College Book Arts Association incorporates, committed to nurturing young talent, along with producing stellar biannual conferences. Well, I imagine I've missed several of your historical favorites, and just send them to me, because this is what I'm collecting right now. But these few signposts among many remind us of how far we have traveled, the good decisions made, and our field's generosity and vision in investing in education, in our younger artists, and in our still nascent collecting community. And did you catch the critical pivot point in the 1980s? It was to recognize, accept, and turn to advantage all that computer technology and the internet had to offer in unlimited access to information, materials, and imagery. The world shifted on its axis for printers, and they went with it, and they regained their footing. Today, we're part of a body electric, a hive community, wired and wireless, all of us humming together. Lost to many is the pure pleasure of a still clock. More than Walt Whitman's sensual body electric in the mid-19th century, more than the 1950s jumpstart through cardiac defibrillators, today the body electric suggests two images to me. First, it expresses our achievements at expanding our knowledge of the brain as an electrical command center. But at the same time, the body electric suggests our struggle to resist the enticements of the hive, to avoid the siren call of distraction and data overload, and to sustain linear thinking, reflection, and body knowledge. As I said, we now inhabit another pivot point. This is no small thing. Remember that it's the pivot at the top that determines where the pendulum's arc will reach in its trajectory. When the pivot shifts, the reach of the arc realigns fundamentally. It's time to collectively find our footing and add our creative momentum to gravity's pull. This 21st century stressor makes our passionate involvement in books only more critical. Books reverse manic data dispersal, one reader at a time, distilling content into a series of openings, movements, and moments. I believe one of our most pressing needs and opportunities is to harness that data stream with content that can be absorbed and reflected upon and then shared with others. Many books at Codex could demonstrate the book form's inherent strengths. Here are three of them. Let's set our electrical context with Sarah Langworthy's On Physical Lines. The text is by James Clerk Maxwell, a late 19th century scientist driven to decode the mysteries of electric and magnetic phenomena and whose research into light as an electromagnetic wave laid the groundwork for Albert Einstein's theory of relativity. Maxwell's voice comes to us from an open weave nest of power lines. His ruminations float as in free verse around lines that cross, dip, and realign. Writing in 1860, Maxwell's remarks reveal a scientist's single-minded pursuit of truth as he muses, quote, lines of force as something real and currents diverge, their continued existence indicates something more. On Physical Lines gathers abstracted lines into a whispered palette with color fields caught in its crossings. Langworthy has found beauty in an electrified skyscape that, in the U.S. alone today, comprises interconnected systems of 2,000 electric distribution utilities, 300,000 miles of transmission and distribution lines, 145 million customers, and 7,300 power plants and generating facilities. Our book arts field owes much to the grid, held by these lines that are ever-present, vulnerable to weather or other assault, yet critical to our first world selves as they transmit evidence of our transitory lives onto living screens. Maxwell's restrained yet compelling voice returns us to those generative efforts, humanizing the science behind the grid. Each of us, artist, writer, or reader, recognizes that creative drive, that insistent questioning behind the quest. Quote, we are dissatisfied, but still, we hope to be of some use. Now look up and through those intersecting power lines and into the stars overhead, mapped throughout millennia of nighttime scrutiny. In Phonetic Constellations of the First Magnitude, Sarah Holsey applies linguistics, which is the study of language and its structure, to the distant starscape. In so doing, she deconstructs our planet's manifold diversity in language into a language that is wordless yet fully visual. Two data sets organize this accordion-folded book. The first is based on part of the chart of the International Phonetic Alphabet, or IPA. This chart represents sound frequencies across the world's languages. We see here the grids for vowels above and consonants below. Our intimate utterances link us one to another as vocalized vibrations that characterize a country's culture, further spiced by region and community with colloquialism and slang. Holsey has freed vocalizations from making meaning, although there is a hierarchy of sorts. The selected sounds that represent the greatest frequency of use throughout the world continue to reside in place on the chart, but Holsey has transmuted them into stars. This second organizing system is based on early modern astronomical charts, such as in our first slide, or in this one, in which early gazers identified an arrow shooting through the galaxy. Those stars that shine the brightest are described as of the first magnitude. So here, Holsey's brightest phonetic constellations represent our world's most prevalent sounds. In other words, those sounds that unite all of us beyond language. Their sizes signify prevalence of use across the globe rather than degrees of brightness. Phonetic constellations of the first magnitude reveals our intimate connection one to another, like a Tower of Babel quieted, voices teased out into essentials, with chaotic chatter realigning into a muted symphony. Along the inside tab of the cover, Holsey provides the IPA symbols for the 30 most common vowels and consonants, like a mysterious code waiting to reveal our own consonants with one another. Where Maxwell's voice in Langworthy's work explores a pivot point, we might say, just preceding discovery, Holsey's work is free of narrative, reconfiguring data to visually reveal the universals held within our diversity. Halsey's book reminded me of a New York subway, where the surround sound is a mélange of intonation, language, and slang, each conversation the product of centuries of making meaning within a particular cultural construct. Now, lift away from the subway and up into space, the cacophony silenced and visually coherent in the planet's containment. However incomprehensible our 21st century chaos, we are linked here below by phonetic correspondences, elemental utterances, shared sounds, each of us making a kind of music, no lyrics, all melody. Different data maps, equally global, comprise our third book, Sarah Bryant's Figure Study, which blooms with color, transparency, and the distillation of a heroic amount of data. Bryant made sense of data by harvesting it, studying and responding to it, and then providing it with an inventive and visually compelling bookish incarnation. She collaborated with David Allen from Middlebury College to compare population data for every region on Earth. We open the enclosure to find luscious, colored hourglass shapes printed from linoleum onto drafting film, housed together alongside a booklet. We manipulate the colorful pages, layering the sheets to recombine the shapes and hues. From sight to touch to playfully building and rebuilding graphic forms, the translucent pages capture and hold our attention. But we soon discover that figure study is dead serious. The images correlate with the booklet's alphabetical and numerical index. At this point, we switch into analytical mode, directed by the artist to decode the visuals, connect the dots. What is the story behind these lovely shapes? The data reveals the true picture. Bryant and Allen compiled population pyramids for every region on Earth and paired them to create abstracted human forms. A thick-waisted form indicates populations that live to an advanced age. Narrow-waisted figures represent low life expectancy. Asymmetrical bulges to the left or right indicate higher male or female life expectancy. From holding to exploring to decoding, Bryant's slow reveal of the data behind the images shifts our perception and grounds our knowledge in the moment and in our own bodies. We realize that, in effect, we are holding the sum totals of lives whose trajectories differ depending on their geography, which in turn affects, for example, the availability of natural resources or the access to healthcare. We can't turn away because we have held and shifted these populations back and forth in our hands, laying them out, layering them, and studying them like playing cards. And that illusion is on target because where we are born is literally the luck of the draw, from country of origin to nutrition, education, and so on. We replace the pages but retain their impact. These books suggest one way that artists' books resist digital overload. Here, abstractions of data leave the screen to be distilled into a sensate object that seeks our hands to hold as our minds absorb content page by page. We take hold and so explore the data's significance through that artist's intention. So I began with history, and doesn't it seem as though our history has led us in a straight line to Codex, our present-day highlight of a flourishing field? But let's recall that history rather suggests that we ask questions such as, what investments should this most generous of fields be making to hold our voices for tomorrow's readers, artists, students, and collectors? Technology again offers possibilities for wider exposure, from, for example, online teaching, which I know is already underway, to live streaming. Imagine listening to an emerging artist's gallery talk in England, or a German collector virtually walking with someone along the aisles of Codex. The possibilities are endless. So it may seem as though we've been having the same conversation for 30 years. How do we reach people? How do we sell books? But as I demonstrated at the start of my comments, we have moved into entirely new territory. All open, no horizon line. Time to think now about our safe passage deeper into the millennium. True to the high stakes of the 21st century, we have much to do, and we will be interrupted and distracted while doing so. Such is the challenge of walking the earth at this time. So let me offer three final thoughts. First, honor the history you are making. Don't stop explaining your work. Every question asked is a gift in a field that demands depth. And even as the book arts attract younger artists, the book form grows alien to others. There is much to be concerned about. We have all heard of grade school kids that swipe at a book's page. So each of us can serve as a conduit to open a listener to a book's sensual, ruminative ecosystem, hand to book, to mind and spirit. Second, honor our past. Remember, we all disappear, our voices grow still, but your books can survive. They do not unplug. As I mentioned, I'm collecting thoughts and memories about the period from 1980 to 2010. Send me your reminiscences and opinions. How do you believe we fed the phoenix return of letterpress? And when did you first see it take flight? If you came to letterpress after 1980, tell me what drew you and how do you see it today and tomorrow? And three, honor our future. Where do you want to be in 2050? More importantly, where will your books reside? Remember the phoenix's upward trajectory against all odds, believe me, in the 1980s. And consider what is needed for the field's future development. The point I'm making here is that over the last 30 years, and beginning when things appeared the most dire for letterpress, many of our field's major developments emerged from a recognition of what was needed, a readiness to innovate with technology to meet those needs, and an investment of energy, talent, and resources. We have done it more than once, and what luck! Here is a pendulum again shifting our way, just within reach. As I have demonstrated, we have altered the pendulum's course before so that today, despite 24/7 data beaming from screens, book art can feed a hunger for substance and depth that haunts many in our society. We also see evidence of this at CBAA conferences, where young artists throng the hallways, manifesting a trend to reunite body with content in illuminating bookish manifestations. So in conclusion, let's work as if this may be the perfect time in history for our work, as if our passion for making books is acutely needed, because it is. Speak back to distraction and don't settle. Make books that offer a depth of content, a devotion to craft, an authority of voice, and I can't say the word risk enough. Please risk. Your books infuse reading with a body-based rhythm, a rhythm close to breath, that unites us and invites us into the circle, a cycle. An analogy might be a slow waltz, with the act of paging a movement of open, pause and turn, a ruminative dance that every reader recognizes on a cellular level. We have what is needed, and with Mary Oliver, let us think about what it is you plan to do with your one wild and precious life. Tell us the stories we need to hear, wherever they lead. Think about what you will leave for us, and then leave us more, always more, of who you are in your truest heart. Thank you.
So if anybody has questions that they'd like to address to either Johannes or Betty, please do so. Time is now. Yes.
So, I'm sorry, you're asking what I think of the new books that are being created by book artists with text? So the question had to do with the act of reading and what I think about the language or the texts that are being used in artist books or the book arts today. To be simplistic about it, I think it's very important that there is language in artist books today. I've done a lot of research on reading and neurology and how our brains are rewiring, and especially how young brains are literally not comfortable with reading linearly. And that's, I just referenced it here, but that could have been an entirely different talk. I think there really is much to celebrate in this field, and I think there is much that we can be inspired to create in opposition to what's all around us every single day. And I think that when there is text on the page, and just as Johannes was talking about setting text and how that focus on language comes into his mind and body when he is either setting lead type or working on a screen, I think the books slow us down. They literally bring into our body that experience of reading, so that when you see a child starting to read, they are literally following it, right, with their finger. So they're bringing it into physical and then into their mind and into their heart. So I guess I think that when I see when I see books at Codex, I'll say one thing. What excites me is when they are bilingual or trilingual, like Johannes's books. I love the idea of language. And when I mentioned Sarah Holsey's work, I like the conceptual focus of going deep into linguistics. So I think the more that we can work with language, either poetry or text on the page, as long as it is a text that the artist is absolutely devoted to, I think that's what we need to do. And then that is brought into the body through paging. Thank you. Yeah.
Karen?
Engaged and distracted by electronic media is because we all have access to electronic media, and of course we are all very privileged to have access to these books. We get to come to Codex and touch them. There's some one-off books here that I would love for everybody to see. How do we get the hands of these precious objects into the hands of all the rest of the world that needs it? How is that even possible? Much less getting young people to come and make the books to slow them down, to get them to engage, you know, ink and paper.
Right. Well, so our friend made the understandable comment of how do we actually get those books into the hands of the youth and of other people across the world today, and that's always been the question. So the point that I'm trying to dance on here is looking back at history and looking how the point was the book arts, and in particular letterpress printers. There was a lot of naysaying about computer technology, but it was actually very rapidly recognized and understood and used to advantage. So instead of simply saying no more screen time, which is really basically up to each family or individual to control, I'm saying let's start thinking about how we can use the large digital access across the world today to bring people into books. It's not ideal. When you have a one-off book, you've got a one-off book. But there are a lot of possibilities within computer technology or software to watch someone paging a book and then hopefully lead them to one of the public collections, which I don't know if anyone's done a full listing of them, but there are so many public collections now of artist books in university collections, in art schools, in some public libraries as well. So we'll always be working with, that's kind of our ongoing issue, isn't it, is looking at an exhibition when the books by necessity have to be behind a display case, or one actually has to go into a library and introduce themselves and talk to a special collections librarian who will probably be thrilled to bring the books out. I mean, that's a simple step. Once you've done it, you recognize that. But a lot of people aren't comfortable with that. It's simply a reality of this format. And so, yeah, that's my hope, is that we can start doing that technological brainstorming now as to how we can do further outreach, I guess.